Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and a very warm welcome to today's broadcast. I'm Veronica Scaresbrick and I'll be with you for the next half hour. Coming up in a few moments. Marking the day the Church remembers St. Francis on a musical note. But first, turning to Germany, following Pope Benedict XVI's first state visit to his homeland, we take a look at an exceptional exhibition in Dresden, which brings together two Raphael masterpieces. And we share the tale of a German author who interviewed a cross-section of people to witness the fall of the Berlin Wall. Well, thanks so much for joining me once again. Professor Arnold Nesselrat is one of the chief curators at the Vatican Museums. I went round to call on him at the museums this week to ask him about an exhibition currently taking place in the German city of Dresden at the Gemälde Galerie Alte Meister. This exhibition, timed to coincide with Benedict XVI's visit to his homeland, is called Heavenly Splendor, and has as centrepiece a Raphael masterpiece depicting Our Lady, known as La Madonna di Foligno, which is currently featured on the cover of the catalogue of this exhibition. A catalogue which, by the way, is the second most sold book in Germany right now. A centrepiece, above all, which is coupled for the first time in history, at least since Raphael's day, with his famous Sistine Madonna, housed in this German art gallery. But I shouldn't give too much away. I'll let Professor Nesselrat do the talking.
The Madonna di Foligno by Raphael is one of those pictures in the Vatican that have never been lent, and are among these objects that the museums never do lend. However, in Dresden they have the famous Sistine Madonna, which everybody knows, with the cheeky angels underneath.
And our highly marketed angels.
Highly marketed. We have a similar angel in our picture, sort of an elder brother, and which is not so marketed. But the two pictures were painted in the same year. They probably even stood next to each other in Raphael's workshop. So the possibility to compare the two pictures was a gift of the Holy Father to Germany. And by staging the exhibition in Dresden, the area which he visited was even sort of slightly enlarged.
What did it stem from? Was it an idea of Dresden's Gemälde Galerie Alte Meister?
No. Dresden will celebrate the 500 years of the Sistine Madonna next year. And the Madonna di Foligno could not be lent for the known political reasons, since it's never lent, to this exhibition. So the German embassy thought it would be a good idea if the Pope could foster also a cultural event in Germany, as he had done last year in England with the tapestry exhibition at the V&A. So this is a similar event of the highest cultural importance, and this is also the press the exhibition got that the Pope, has made this event possible.
Can you tell me a little bit about these Madonnas? They're very famous, particularly the one in Dresden, strangely enough, is more famous than the one in the Vatican, which was painted earlier, the Foligno one. They don't look very much alike in the sense that from the naked eye, from the eye of the beholder, someone who perhaps doesn't know much about art, they look very different. The one in Dresden is the later one, and it seems like a vision, no? Whereas the Madonna di Foligno, the earlier one, has two parts to it. There's a heavenly vision and also an earthly one, because it's like a sacred conversation that's going on beneath the Madonna.
The two pictures represent two visions of the Madonna. This is something they have in common. But the Dresden picture shows also four figures in the fresco that have this vision and invite the onlooker to participate in the vision. While the Dresden picture, the Sistine Madonna, is a vision all by itself, where the drawn curtain and the two cheeky angels are sort of the mediators to the reality of the onlooker. But the Sistine Madonna is sort of developed out of the idea of the Madonna di Foligno. And in the exhibition in Dresden, we have a sketch by Raphael, which probably has to be located chronologically between the two pictures, where you can, so to speak, see how the Madonna di Foligno rises and sort of stands up and moves towards the onlooker as she does in the Sistine Madonna. So conceptually, they are linked, sort of one follows out of the other. The painterly qualities are very similar. Both pictures are painted either in parallel or at either end of the Mass of Bolsena. So if you put the fresco in the stanza in the Vatican and the two Madonnas together, you get probably a complete stylistic evolution of what Raphael is doing in 1512 when he's also interested in Venetian painting, which is a very strong element technically, stylistically, as far as the colors are concerned. And one of the first impressions that everybody had when we came into the room in Dresden was that we finally understood the colors of the Sistine Madonna, because it has this extremely yellow varnish on it. Our Madonna, the Madonna di Foligno, has been cleaned in 1957. We have re-varnished it, and you can see sort of the red and the blue, which is a real Titian red, and the Sistine Madonna is wearing the same draperies as the Madonna di Foligno, which is something that strikes you when you walk into the room in Dresden. But since it's coated with this yellow varnish, you don't perceive this normally when you stand in front of the picture in Dresden. So there are a number of revelations that we have when we see the two pictures together.
From what you're saying, this is the first time since 1511 that the two paintings have been side by side.
This is correct. Both pictures then were kept in a very remote place, the Sistine Madonna in Piacenza, the Madonna di Foligno, which gets put up on the high altar in Santa Maria in Araceli here in Rome. 50 years later, it's moved to Foligno, from where it takes its name, and then only sort of travellers who came by saw these pictures.
Foligno is in central Italy, it's in Umbria.
Foligno is in Umbria, Piacenza is in the north of Italy. They're not places that are generally visited as, for example, Roman churches. And that's why they didn't have such an impact on art history until the Duke of Saxony bought the Sistine Madonna. Then, of course, it became extraordinarily important for people like Winckelmann, for people like Goethe, for people like the Russian writers, Tolstoy, Dostoevsky, and all these people.
They mention it in their novels, do they?
They mention it in their novels. Dostoevsky takes his wife there, and he sits in front of this picture. He prepares her to go into that room, and he almost prays in front of the picture. Hans Christian Andersen, a famous author of the fairy tales, he says every sensible Catholic who comes into that room starts praying. So the Madonna is having an enormous impact culturally, but also spiritually. And the same thing happens with the Madonna di Foligno, because that's taken as a war booty by Napoleon to France. They restore it, then it comes back here, and then it becomes an important picture. But since the Sistine Madonna was not taken to Paris, the two pictures have never been together. The Sistine Madonna was taken as war booty by Stalin to Moscow, and it was exhibited in Moscow. And again, this impact it had on Dostoevsky, it seems to have had also on Stalin, because they sort of created a room in the Pushkin Museum for it, which was like a little church. So basically, in Stalin's Moscow, they venerated the Madonna in the way they displayed it in the museum. So this impact that these pictures have is a fairly late development, but this is also something that we're experiencing now in Dresden, where both Christian parishes, the Catholics and the Protestants, have decided to dedicate the whole of Advent to the interpretation of the Madonna, and in particular to these two pictures.
So the popes, who were patrons of art and artists, got it right in terms of evangelizing.
Well, and I think Pope Benedict got it right, because the impact that these two pictures are having in Dresden is quite extraordinary.
My thanks there go to Professor Arnold Nesserath, one of the chief curators at the Vatican Museums, for speaking to us of the two Raphael paintings currently on show in the exhibition Heavenly Splendor. As a matter of interest, this exhibition also features Albrecht Dürer and Matthias Grunewald. And if you're heading anywhere near Dresden, remember you can see this exhibition until the 8th of January. At the Gemälde Galerie Alte Meister. And now let's leave Dresden with its artistic masterpieces and focus for a moment on the nation's capital, Berlin, and on a particular chapter in its history. Pope Benedict XVI's first official visit to Germany, which took place in September, began in the nation's capital, Berlin, a city once at the heart of 20th century geopolitics, as the stage of Nazi Germany and subsequent Cold War. One which has moved beyond East-West boundaries ever since the reunification of Germany, which took place on the 3rd of October 1990, as a result of a clamorous historical event which paved the way to that reunification, the fall of the wall, that 162-kilometre wall that had divided Berlin in two for 28 long years.
In Berlin, everyone lived right next to the wall, so that's where things happened.
The day to remember is the 9th of November 1989. 20 years on, to mark that same date, a German author by the name of Victoria Struckwitz set out to interview a cross-section of 20 people from each side of that wall, shining the spotlight on their personal witness in an effort to put people into the picture.
I wanted to get a good picture of Berlin. So I interviewed people from different generations, different social backgrounds, different responsibilities. Some people had no responsibility at all. They were flower ladies, or they worked in a pub, or they actually went to school. And some people were very responsible or had very responsible functions.
Among those key players in this event, whom Victoria interviewed, were the mayor of West Berlin at the time, Walter Momper, the last commandant of the British sector in West Berlin, Sir Robert Corbett, and Gunter Schabowski, who in a sense triggered the opening of borders by raising popular expectations during a famous press conference.
I spoke to Gunter Schabowski, who got it all going by giving a press conference saying that people could actually travel to West Germany and West Berlin without special permissions, without special reasons.
Victoria chose to give the book the title of Nothing Special Occurred, Because of those words pronounced by some of the officials in East Berlin at the time, with the intention of playing down the historical significance of this event. She pronounces those same words in German for us.
Keine besonderen Vorkommnisse is a basically military phrase in Germany. And the next day, the West German president, Bundespräsident Weizsäcker, was visiting the Potsdamer Platz, and he came up to an East German policeman, and the policeman saluted and said, nothing special occurred, keine besonderen Vorkommnisse. And the president of West Germany thought, well, something very special had occurred yesterday.
Victoria, would you say there's a collective memory of this event, or do people's recollections differ between East and West, for example?
Yes, totally, immensely. The West was totally taken by surprise, people in charge, and they acted quite well and improvised quite well. And in the East, there were people taken by surprise. One lady, she told me, got a phone call for her son lived in West Berlin and she lived in East Berlin. And on the night of the 9th of November, after the news was out that the borders would open, she got a call from her son saying the borders would open and they should meet half an hour later at one of the border crossings on the west side. And so she jumped into her car and drove to the border and was pretty surprised because she was overtaken by other cars. And she thought she was the only one with the news. And she thought she was the only one who knew that now one could sneak out and into West Berlin. And then she was caught up in the traffic jam as well, as everyone else. And so she was taken by surprise that the wall opened and that so many people knew about it. But many, many people in East Germany, and especially in East Berlin, actually weren't taken by surprise. For them, it was a consequence of what had happened in the autumn of 1989. There were peaceful demonstrations, and Pierre Gorbachev in Russia, and many of them actually, they got the news, and then they went to bed, because they thought, oh, that's very nice, that's very good news, everything worked out peacefully, so we can go to bed and look at West Berlin another day.
What Victoria discovered in the course of her research was a high risk factor connected to the opening of the borders she hadn't previously taken into consideration.
What was new to me when I did the research for the book and when I interviewed people was that the GDR was prepared to use their military to defend the wall. I always thought, or it always sounded to me, like a peaceful revolution. In the end, it was a peaceful revolution, but for something like 2 days, the GDR was actually prepared to defend their wall by military means. They actually mobilized over 30,000 elite soldiers to defend the wall because they want to defend the territory. And the police president of West Berlin told me he worked with the Eastern police at the Brandenburg Gate to calm down the situation. Basically, the heart of the wall was around the Brandenburg Gate for the East Germans of both sides, but especially for the East side to defend. On the 9th of November, many West Berlin people jumped over the wall at the Brandenburg Gate and said, open the gate, let us go through. And they actually walked through. And on the night, 10th of November, the East wouldn't let that happen. They actually tried to push back the people, and the West was pretty alarmed because they thought if there's one dead body on either side, the East will use.
The loss of one person's life might have changed the outcome of the event from peaceful to bloody.
Because of the West German police on that side, they calmed down the situation, which was very difficult because the two police couldn't speak to each other except by word of mouth. So they had to scream over the wall. There was no phone connection between the two police, the East and the West German. And later on, when the Allies visited the regiment around Berlin, they actually found out that there was something called the außerordentliche Gefechtsbereitschaft, which meant all the soldiers had to go back to on the night of the 9th to the 10th of all had to go back to their regiments and actually were sitting in running cars, ready to move to, which they then didn't.
You were listening there to German author Victoria Strachwitz, whose book Nothing Special Occurred, focusing on the fall of the wall 20 years on, will hopefully be translated into English sometime. Finally, I'd like to end the broadcast on a musical note by bringing you a programme focusing on St. Francis of Assisi, whose feast day we celebrated this past week on October the 4th. That's with our music historian, Monsignor Philip Whitmore.
We've just been listening to a modern opera by the great French composer Olivier Messiaen. It was written in 1983, when the composer was 75 years old. Messiaen was a man of deep faith, and it came as no surprise that he chose a religious subject for this, his first and only opera. It's about St. Francis of Assisi. That was St. Francis himself, leading the friars in morning prayer. He's singing a passage from one of his most famous prayers, the Canticle of the Sun.
All praise be yours, my Lord, through all that you have made, and first my Lord, brother Sun, who brings the day, through whom you give us light. All praise be yours, my Lord, through sister Moon and stars. In the heavens you have made them bright, precious and fair. All praise be yours, my Lord, through brothers wind and air, both fair and stormy, all the weather's moods, by which you cherish all that you have made. All praise be yours, my Lord, through sister water, so useful, humble, precious, and pure.
St. Francis's love of creatures, especially animals, has inspired many artists and musicians over the centuries. Some of you may know the lovely fresco by Giotto of St. Francis feeding the birds. Rather less well known is a short piano piece by the 19th century Hungarian composer Franz Liszt. It paints a picture in sound of St. Francis preaching to the birds. As you can hear, the birds are still quite excited at this point, but later in the piece they calm down and pay a bit more attention to the saintly preacher. St. Francis has inspired hymn writers too. His Canticle of the Sun is the basis of a popular hymn. All creatures of our God and King, lift up your voice and with us sing, O praise him, Alleluia. The tune is a German chorale, Lasst uns erfreuen, written in Cologne early in the 17th century. The original words were addressed to Our Lady, rejoicing that her sorrows had been banished by the resurrection of her Son. That's why there are so many Alleluias. The tune has spread to many different countries, and new texts have been supplied not only in English, but in Italian, in Portuguese, and in other languages too. It was a truly inspired choice by the country clergyman William Draper to make an adaptation of St. Francis's Canticle of the Sun to be sung to this tune. Those ringing alleluias perfectly match the joyful spirit of praise pouring forth from sun and stars, earth and seas, and from every creature of our God and King.
And heartfelt thanks there, as always, to Monsignor Philip Whitmore, a music historian who's currently working as an official at the Vatican's Secretariat of State. End this programme on a reflective note. That's with Chris Altieri, who reads some thoughts from St. Francis of Assisi.
Happy is he who, when he is honoured and esteemed by men, thinks no more of himself than when he was humbled and despised. Because a man is only what he is in the eyes of God, and nothing more. Of all the gifts of the Holy Spirit, the principal is the grace to conquer self and willingly to suffer injuries for the love of God. When the servant of God is a prey to sadness, he ought at once to have recourse to prayer and remain in all humility before his Father and Lord until he restores to him the joy of his salvation.
And that brings me up to time. I do hope you enjoyed this broadcast. I'm Veronica Scaresbrick. Thanks so much for listening. Don't forget, we'll be back again at the same time tomorrow. Meanwhile, should you wish to check out our website, the address is www.vaticanradio.org. Bye for now.
You've been listening to the English program of Vatican Radio. Laudator Jesus Christus.